This is the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Robin Johnson's cross, and it's a brilliant save from Belshaw. How did he keep out Michael Smith?
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with this week's guest, who is a goalkeeper with quite the story to tell. From Nottingham to North Carolina and back again, he's been drafted, he's been shafted, he's bagged a bunch of promotions, been named in numerous teams of the week and won a silver medal for Great Britain at the World University Games. He's even had a dog named after him. And according to his current boss, if he carries on playing as he is, he'll be getting a statue built outside the Mem. A-star student James Belshaw, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for that introduction. Yeah, I think it's sounds more glamorous than it is, but no, great. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. Before we begin, we should say we are in the salubrious surroundings of where exactly? What's the town?
We're in Carlton.
Carlton.
Yeah, in Nottingham. Right. Yeah.
Lovely. And this is the area. Well, you didn't grow up specifically here, but Nottingham was where.
No. Nottingham was where I grew up. Yeah, I was born in Clifton in Nottingham, and then sort of stayed around the area. And like you said there, my career's kind of taken me to far corners of the globe and all around the country. But yeah, Nottingham's where all my family's from, where I'm living now with my wife and settled there. So
good stuff. Well, we're in for a penny, a pub in Carlton, in the upstairs room. Function might be a bit echoey.
Yeah, no, we'll be sound. I can't say I've ever been here before, but no, we'll make it work.
So before every podcast, we start with some quick fire questions. Now, normally I have my cohort Richard Lee here with me, so I'm rudderless today without Richard, but I'm going to throw them your way anyway, okay? Yep. So three quick fire questions with two bonus ones that I'm going to chuck in from here on in. So the first one is gloves. What gloves do you wear?
So I'm with Asmir's AB1. I've been with Asmir for about 4 or 5 years now. They've been really good with me. Gloves are great. I think any goalkeeper will tell you, once you find a pair of gloves that work for you, you want to keep them. And Asmir, the brand's developed, evolved. I think Asmir is obviously doing a lot with his academies and stuff. I feel like I'm plugging him now. we're the AB1s. Got some of the new white and golds I'm going to be wearing in the next few games. So yeah, they've been great with me.
White and gold.
Yeah. I've got the been wearing some black ones at the minute, the Neros. I've worn them. They actually stopped making my favourite ones. They had like a surround cut, like really tight around the sort of the middle fingers with a quartz grip that lasted quite well. They stopped making them, but no, I can wear anything.
Okay, favourite kit over the years?
Oh, favourite kit. Favourite kit would probably be when I was a kid. I had so I'm a Notts County fan. So family are big Notts County fans. So I had when I was sort of 5 or 6, there was a couple of goalkeeper ones. There was a red one and there was like a green and yellow one. It had a Sapper big logo on the front, Notts County goalkeeper kits.
Okay.
And it was a red one and a green and yellow one. And when I was in the academy at Notts, we wore them. And just looking back at pictures from when I was a kid, they were the ones that, remember, you were really buzzing to wear, wanted to wear it all the time. So I'll go with those ones. Yeah, 90, but probably up 96, 97, something like that.
I like that. So it's a kit you've seen a previous goalkeeper wear, not one that you've worn yourself.
Yeah, the first goalkeeper I saw wear it was Darren Ward at Notts. He was like my big kind of hero sort of as a kid, like really wanted to be Darren Ward. I think he's working with the Lionesses now as a goalkeeper coach there. But yeah, he was the first goalkeeper at Notts County that I really saw, and obviously saw him wearing the kit, and myself obviously playing for the sort of academy size at Notts County got to wear that. So yeah, that's probably my favourite one.
Okay, and the last of the three, most memorable save. Now, as we always say, doesn't have to be the most important save, doesn't have to be the best save you've ever made, but just one that sticks in the mind for you.
Oh, most memorable save. Put me on the spot here. Okay, so I'll go with this one. It wasn't necessarily a save. I know a lot of Rovers fans will enjoy this one. We played at Oxford in the FA Cup last year, and we ended up winning 4-3 in extra time. We were 3-1 down in the first half extra time, came back to win 4-3, and it was actually a bit of sweeping up that I did. So anyone that's seen me play my start position, quite an aggressive goalkeeper, like to sort of defend the space quite high in behind the back four, and there's a ball over the top, and I think Matty Taylor was sort of put through, and I'm like close to the halfway line, and I've put a tackle in, and sort of kind of like a mid-height tackle, and if I didn't get the ball, I'm either bringing him down and I'm sent off, or he's clean through, and managed to win the ball and then put us in behind for a chance. So not really a save as such, but that was one that kind of stuck in my mind.
Oh, I love that, because yeah, we always say on the podcast that we feel like at some point you feel like you've covered almost everything. But I tell you what, every time we do an interview, something new always crops up. And that's a first. We've not had a goalkeeper flag, yeah, a tackle essentially, yeah, a piece of sweeping up.
Pretty much what it was, yeah, a tackle pretty much on the halfway line from our corner to stop a counter-attack. So, yeah, I know Rovers fans enjoy that one because of the Matty Taylor connections. But yeah, it was that's one that sticks in my mind.
Okay, and a couple of others that we're just going to throw in quickly. You might have already answered this with the Darren Ward reference, but goalkeeping idol.
Yeah, so the first one was Darren Ward at Notts County. Just remember going to watch him and just being like, you know, like starstruck like you are when you're sort of 6, 7 years old. But then growing up, when I started to sort of pay attention to goalkeeping, Peter Schmeichel was a big one. I'm sure you get that a lot. But one that I'll say that's probably, because I think he's about the same age as me, was David De Gea. And the reason why I'll go with David De Gea was because he came over here, had a very sort of tough time of it, got put through the mill by press, sort of was lambasted by other coaches, managers, decisions were questioned. And I remember Fergie sort of doing an interview saying, you'll see his potential. And the way he sort of fought through that and became, for probably 3 or 4 years, the best goalkeeper in the world. So yeah, I think people like that you sort of admire and sort of admire like the strength of character, because being a goalkeeper, you know what it's like to go through times like that. You know how difficult it can be. And especially on the global level, like he's playing and he's had an unbelievable career. So yeah, I'll throw his name in there as well.
Okay. And the final one, the best goalkeeper that you've either played with or against.
Got a few mates that I'm gonna have to say. Here, best goalkeeper. So, as a kid, one of my mates I played when I came through at Walsall, Rene Gilmartin, who's now at Ipswich.
Yes. Yeah.
So big Rene looked after me when I was in the youth team at Walsall, and he was there, and yeah, get on really well with Rene. So I'll have to throw his name out there.
Giant of a man.
Yeah, right, big bloke. Yeah. Yeah, I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago. Actually, he's a top bloke. Rene is, and. Best goalkeeper played against. Played against some good ones. One of my other mates, Nathan Ashmore, in non-league, played against Nath quite a few times. And he's pulled worldies against us, and he's a top lad, so yeah, I'll go Nath as well.
Follow-up effort from Thomas is closed down as well, but West Brom really let rip there, and now Belshaw's had to come out to the centre circle to tackle Matty Taylor and stop him going past him into an open goal. Blimey, Belshaw's almost up on the halfway line.
Good stuff. Okay. Well, look, it's great to have you on. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. We're going to journey through your career, which has been incredibly varied, quite the story, I think quite unique in terms of the goalkeepers we've spoken to over the years. I referenced a quote there at the beginning from your current manager, Joey Barton. I've got another quick one that I'm going to read out for you as well. And that is, Bellison is as good as Alisson and we got him on a free from Harrogate. Have you heard that one?
Yeah, I heard that one. Yeah, that was towards the end of last year. It was actually that Oxford game I alluded to. I think we played against that and played against Oxford in the FA Cup, and we were doing like the debrief of it, and like nickname obviously get called Belly, and we're doing the debrief, and the gaffer just dropped in front of the lads. He was like, "Yeah, and Bellison's there to make the save," and then it kind of like everyone just sort of looked around, and it sort of stuck, and the staff will call me Bellison when things are sort of going well. But yeah, then he went obviously public with that. I think it was towards the end of last season. I think we drew 0-0 with Forest Green, sort of third or fourth game from the end of the season, and saw that quote come up. As soon as you see that, getting it pinged across in all the WhatsApp groups that I'm in, everyone's screenshotting it. But yeah, I guess if you're being compared to Alisson, you're doing something right. I don't think I'm quite at that level, but...
You take it.
Yeah. Oh, not wrong. Yeah, take it every day of the week. Yeah, 100%. He's one of the best goalkeepers in the world, so don't mind that.
So you're 32... now, right, currently in your third campaign in the EFL, earning a whole bunch of plaudits along the way. I guess my first question to you is, where on earth have you been? Where have you been all this time?
Yeah, I think with goalkeeping and with football in general, like, ability only gets you so far, hard work only gets you so far. I think it's the opportunities that sort of come along at the right time, and whether you take those chances or not, or some just takes one person to kind of believe in you and give you that opportunity. And yeah, I've been sort of plying my trade in non-league for sort of 6, 7, 8 years before I got the chance in the Football League. I made my Football League debut the week I turned 30. So when I was growing up and when I was in the sort of non-league system, I was always believed that I could play in the Football League, always had that belief in my own ability, and just waiting for that kind of opportunity. And I had to sort of go through with the promotions. Like, you see lads in non-league sort of get bought and they'll skip a few leagues. I had to kind of, every league I've been in, I've had to get promoted out of it to progress, which has given me some fantastic sort of moments in football. And I've met some great friends along the way. But yeah, I guess at 32 now, kind of trying to make up for lost time and hopefully can go on for a good few years yet.
To be fair, I've just realised at the top in that intro, I used the word drafted and shafted. I should have used grafted as well, because just what you said there, going up through the leagues, you've had to really graft.
Yeah, well, I was at Tamworth for a number of years, playing semi-pro, part-time football training, Tuesday, Thursday nights, working a full-time job, sort of 7 till 5, 6, then going to training, starting training at Tamworth, sort of like 8, half 8 at night, and getting home at 11 and or even midnight, and then doing the same thing the next day. Like, it was tough. It took a lot of graft and a lot of kind of belief. And like I said, I always was desperate to get that chance in the Football League. And I think had I not made it, I'd look back on my career and with a bit of regret, I guess, because whether it's like missed opportunities or, do you know what I mean, not taking chances. But I finally got, again, had to earn the chance. I signed for Harrogate full-time in the Conference North in 2017. So I was 26, 27 at the time. And at that time, I was working full-time, playing for Tamworth. I started my own coaching business. So it was just like, something's got to give. Like, I just had too much on. There was not enough hours in the day to do what I was doing. And so I took a massive sort of financial hit, spoke to the manager at Harrogate. They had a project that they were building, Simon Weaver. They wanted to go full-time in the Conference North. So there was, I think there was only us in Salford at the time that went full-time that year. And it was something that, a project that I wanted to be a part of. It was an opportunity to play full-time football. I guess I didn't really have like a name in football to kind of jump up the leagues. I'd spoken to, I had a couple of decent seasons at Tamworth and spoke to a couple of clubs in the EFL at the time, but there was never anything sort of materialised from it. And then sort of bought into this project at Harrogate, where they signed a lot of young, hungry lads that had never played in the Football League. And there was a group of us that went from Conference North to League Two in the space of 3 years. So that story, that journey of what we did there was remarkable, to take Harrogate Town from the Conference North to the Football League. And yeah, finally got my chance in the Football League at 30.
That hunger is so big, isn't it? And that desire too, which is talked about so often in the game now, and I guess which it's argued some players, maybe more so higher up in the game, maybe lack in some ways. But you were in your mid to late 20s, like you said there, when you signed a full-time deal at what would have been, what, a sixth-tier club. It's not something you see that often, a bit more now perhaps with the investment coming into non-league. But that's a huge decision to make at that time in your life. So what's going through your mind in times like that? You're having to quit your job. You're effectively seeing it as a last chance saloon, perhaps. Was it now or never? Was there an element of the dream not happening and maybe giving up hope before that?
I wouldn't say giving up hope, but as you get older, you almost think the less likely it's going to become. Because even though as a goalkeeper, they say you prime sort of early to mid-30s, that chance just wasn't coming. It just wasn't coming. And it's easy to kind of get disheartened. It's easy to kind of down tools or chuck it in and go, you know what, like, I'm working a job, getting paid all right money, playing part-time, got my coaching business. Like, it would have been easy to kind of carry that on. I think just mentally I got to a point when I was just burnt out. I remember sitting down with my manager at Tamworth and the assistant manager a few games to go in the end of the season and was just like, I'm drained here. Like, I just had, like, burning the candle at both ends, had so much going on. And then it was, I'd never worked with an agency. I still didn't have an agent then. I'd heard that Harrogate were interested through someone. So I just followed one of the Harrogate lads on Twitter that I played against and just said, oh, can I have your manager's number? And he gave me his number and I just texted him and just said, hi, Simon, it's James Belshaw here from Tamworth. Like, are you interested in having a chat? And he came back and was like, absolutely, like, let's meet and sit down. So obviously if I don't go and get his number, like I said, they've not recruited me, they've not spoke to me. I think I must have been on their radar. But that's the way I sort of reached out to him and met him for a coffee. And like you said, yeah, took a massive pay cut. At the time, I'd just bought a house. So I had a house, had a mortgage, was settled in Nottingham. Harrogate's obviously 2 hours away from Nottingham. So there was a lot of things that didn't quite align. But I thought, you know what, this is an opportunity to play full-time football. Mentally, more than anything, it gives me a chance to relax more. It gives me a chance to kind of realign my focuses. And like I said, when you're doing that much, you can't put 100% into it. And I think what I found the difference between sort of part-time football and full-time football, even though it was the same standard, was just the mindset of the players that are doing it. Because when you play part-time football, a lot of people play it for different reasons. Some people play it for money, some do it for fitness, some do it for a laugh with a mate. It's like some do it to have a beer after a game. Some do it because they want to win. Like you just get a sort of melting pot of different kind of motivations to when you're trying to align that towards being successful and gaining promotions, it's quite hard. Whereas when you step out of that and go into full-time football, lads are like, well, if I don't perform, I'm not getting a contract, I'm not paying my mortgage. Because when you play semi-pro, your football money is kind of like your, I don't know, your weekend money, so to speak. You've got your job that kind of, that pays your mortgage, that pays your bills. So you know if you don't play or you don't perform, your bills are still going to be paid. Whereas when you go into full-time football, and again, in National League North, with all due respect, like the money's not great, you're sort of thinking, I've got to perform here. And that kind of alignment of lads we signed, I signed from Tamworth, we had lads that signed from Darlington, FC United, North Ferriby, like sort of, with all due respect, kind of like average kind of non-league clubs, and brought together in this team. They just went toe-to-toe with a Salford side at the time that were spending sort of vast amounts of money and managed to get promoted to the playoffs. So, yeah, it was a very difficult decision. I had, like I said, a lot of responsibilities at the time. I wanted to kind of give it a go. At that point, I didn't think the story would obviously go the way it did. I thought, this is an opportunity to play full-time football. I thought we'd definitely be in the promotion mix in the National League North. But then it's like, okay, how much further can this go? And then we got promoted to the National League and lost in the playoffs in our first year there. And then COVID year, we went and won the playoffs at Wembley. So with pretty much the same group of lads that came out of the Conference North. So doing that with some of your best mates, few of the lads are at my wedding, like I saw a couple of them at the weekend, like some of your best mates in football. It was, yeah, a really sort of special time. But the decision, it wasn't an easy decision. But I just thought, it was mainly a mental thing. It was mainly I needed that kind of, needed a break from that sort of, not rat race, but that kind of way of life that I was, where I was grafting all day, got playing Tuesday nights, Thursday nights, travelling all over the country on a Saturday. I needed to kind of focus on it, and it allowed me to do it.
There's so much to be said about that, isn't there? And that's something that Rich actually alludes to a lot on the podcast, is the fact that when he was a player, he had so many other business interests going on. And I think it's quite easy at times to get carried away with that and think about your life after football and think about the fact that you do have that free time. But mentally, like you say, it can be so exhausting. And when you are in it, it's actually worth for 10, 15, 20 years, however long it may be, to go, do you know what? I'm going to put everything into this, and all the other stuff can just wait.
Yeah, so the job that I was in, it wasn't a career, so to speak. It was a job that I'd kind of fell into through a family friend and ended up doing really well with it. Like, it was a good company that I was working for in Nottingham. But then setting up my coaching business, playing for Harrogate allowed me to keep that up. And I think that I do want to stay in football after I finish playing. But I think from Rich there, that's a fantastic sort of eye-opener for a lot of people, because people think, yeah, football is, it's a short career. Everyone's like, the PFA was like, plan for life after football, plan for life after football. And yes, I think it's extremely important to do that. And the coaching company was kind of allowing me to start dabbling into that. Ended up running it for 7 years and setting up a goalkeeping branch and an outfield branch, and it was doing really well. But it starts to take your focus away from football. And when we got into the Football League with Harrogate, it was kind of like, okay, like, I'm in the Football League now. This is kind of my chance to really sort of kick on and do something. And it sort of stayed in the background. And I think what was good about the coaching company was I never allowed it to become my main focus. It kind of ran itself. I put work into it when I needed to it. But my main goal when I went full-time was to, go on then, let's have a right crack at this and see how far I can take it. And the opportunities to coach, the opportunities to stay in football. I'd like to do some media stuff. I'd like to kind of stay in the game, whether I want to go like upstairs into boardrooms or something. I don't know what I want to do in football. I haven't got like a set sort of goal. So for now, to just enjoy doing the best job in the world. And like, I was having a conversation with one of the lads the other day, like, sometimes you get that, you still get that like imposter syndrome. Like, you're still sort of playing in League One and you're looking at the side you're playing against. I remember we played played at Hillsborough on telly on a Wednesday night in Sky back in October. I ended up getting man of the match and did well in the game. But remember the start of the game, all the fans are doing the high old Sheffield Wednesday chant. And you're looking around going, Jesus, like this is proper football here. And you kind of like go, you have that sort of moment where you go, how have I got here? I spent most of my career playing, with all due respect, at like Chorley, Bradford Park Avenue, Leamington, like those kind of grounds. And then all of a sudden you're at Hillsborough, places like that. But then you go out there and you perform because it's just a game of football. Like, I've done it hundreds of thousands of times. I'm not being asked to go out and tap dance in front of 20, 30,000 people. I'm going out to play a game of football, which I know I can do. And because I feel like I've got here on merit with the promotions, I've not had that kind of, that big move where someone's gone, right, we'll take him out and put him straight into League One. I've had to work my way up the leagues. And you kind of relax into it and realise, you know what, I am good enough to be here. I've got here on merit, and how far can you take it? Like, I'm 32 years old now, like, what's to say there's not another promotion? There's not anything down the line. You don't know. Football has a weird way of rewarding good people. So I think if you're a good person and you work hard, you commit to your craft, I think you'll always find yourself progressing, you'll always find success. So for me, like, what I've done, I am really proud of what I've done and how hard I've worked to get here, but I don't want to stop here. 32 years old, 33 in October, but I want to keep going. I want to get another promotion. I want to get to a point when you look back on your career and go, do you know what, that was something really incredible. And I think even if I stopped playing now, I'd be pleased with how I've done, but you know, I've got hopefully 6-7 years left of playing to go and do something really special.
Do you think that is also because you've come into the game quite late, the professional game quite late, so you have that hunger to keep going? 32 is still young, especially for a goalkeeper. I guess you can look at the likes of an Emi Martinez, who we speak a lot about on the podcast. He's 30 now, I believe. And you almost feel like his career is just starting. So many years in the wilderness, I guess, at Arsenal, all those loan spells, eventually got his chance, kind of by luck. And as we know, has taken that chance. Now a World Cup winner, doing well with Aston Villa. We'll see what the future holds for him. But he's 30 now, and it feels like he's just starting.
Yeah, I think with football, there's no blueprint. There's no like right way to do it. You can, excuse me, you can have the best coaching at the top academies in the world, and you see a lot of youngsters now get a lot of money, a lot of fame, a lot of success early on, and then that hunger can sometimes leave. Whereas when you've got lads who, what I found, I can't really speak too much for lads at the top end because I've never been there, but where I've been with lads at the bottom end in non-leagues, there's a lot of good players in non-league. And I think if you find the lads that are hungry and that want to develop and want to keep working hard, then that's a recipe for success. And it doesn't matter whether you're playing in the Football League at 18, 19. Like, yeah, if you're playing at that sort of age, you're going to get a move to a bigger club. But then if you're like an Emi Martinez, you get your chance at that sort of age, and there's no, like, so he's just been voted the best goalkeeper in the world, and he's probably played a handful of Premier League games compared to many of the sort of household names. I think hunger comes from having something inside you, whether it's a point to prove, whether it's an intrinsic desire to better yourself. It has to come from somewhere. And I think lads that have not had things handed to them or had to really sort of graft and go against the grain, whether you're 32 years old or whether you're 22 years old, you then have that sort of, that bit between your teeth to go and improve. And yeah, with me, like, I'm still learning. I've played, I don't know, 120 league games now. And as I said, I played my first one when I was 30. I'm 32 now, so just coming up to the end of my third season in the Football League. But yeah, it's taken a hell of a lot of work to get here. But like I said, that hunger and that desire to kind of get to this level and sort of mix it with your likes of Sheffield Wednesday, Portsmouth, those kind of clubs. I remember when I signed for Bristol Rovers, with all due respect to Harrogate, like, Harrogate was an unbelievable story. It's a non-league club that we took into the Football League and is now doing very well to still be a Football League club. But I signed for Bristol Rovers and you realise this is a proper football club. Like, when I signed there and you go out, you see the fans, it was the year after COVID, so the fans had just come back after the COVID break, and you sort of like, okay, now I've got 10, 11,000 people here all behind you wanting you to do well. And that like pressure of performing for those people and knowing that you can put a smile on those people's faces when they go home, and I'm sure we're touching it, but what we did last year at the football club was nothing short of miraculous. And to be a part of that and to be a part of the history of a big club like Bristol Rovers, for me, again, is something that I'm extremely proud of.
That gap as well between non-league and the Football League, it's getting a lot smaller now because teams in National League North are going pro like you did at Harrogate. Did you notice a difference? So when you stepped into the EFL with Harrogate, having gone up from the National League, did you notice a difference at all?
Yes. Yeah. I think there's a lot of lads that go into League Two, and the when you speak to most people, the general consensus is there's not that much of a gap between the leagues. But I think there is. I think teams at the top end of National League, I mean, we take the National League, for example, now Notts and Wrexham are two clubs that do well in League Two next year. Beyond that, there's not many clubs that you'd look at with all due respect to them and go, they'd be a stable League Two side. I think the fact that no National League club has been relegated from League Two in their first season in the Football League does speak volumes, but I do think there's a gap. I think to then get promoted and get promoted again is a very sort of tough thing to do. I found that in League Two, it's a lot more physical, players are a little bit quicker, strikers more clinical, and the same into League One. I think the gap between League Two and League One, especially, you've got kind of the top sort of six to eight in League One that are all Championship clubs. They're all massive clubs that have big budgets, that have big name players in the league. And I think the gap between that sort of top end, and you can just look at the League One table to see that. So there is a difference in standard as you go up the league. But what you find is with us, like Bristol Rovers and what we did with Harrogate, you add like a little bit of quality. You have add someone who's got experience at that level to buy into the group. And then you've got lads who have played a lot higher that have kind of dropped down the leagues. Then you've got lads like myself who are just coming up for the first time and finding the feet. But we've got a good sort of mix of youth experience. We've got some young Prem lads on loan that are doing really well for us. Got some more experienced lads that have played even higher. There is a difference between the leagues, but you find yourself kind of growing to the level and learning and developing, and yeah, like to think you can mix it with them.
A nice layoff by Smith and a brilliant stop from Belshaw, getting down to that. Smith linking up with Windass, and Belshaw came up with the answer.
What's so unique about your story, James? And it's funny you mentioned the PFA there and the fact that they're constantly telling players to plan for life after football, plan, plan, plan. You have effectively done it the other way around. Now, you have not planned for life after football, but you've prepared to an extent for life, but before your career started. Mm-hmm. So correct me if I've got any of this wrong, but you were at Notts County for a while, had to leave there because their academy shut down. So that was just a matter of fact. You just had to leave. Mm-hmm. Forest weren't interested at the time. Apparently you were too small.
That
classic one. Yeah. But then you were scouted at sixth form by Walsall.
Yep.
Offered a pro deal, but you turned it down.
Yeah, so that was kind of the start of planning for life, I guess. So I was at sixth form doing my A-levels. So I'd just come off my GCSEs. I got 10 A-stars and 2 A's at my GCSEs, so I'd done all right at school. So I wanted to stay at sixth form. I wanted to sort of have that kind of education behind me, because football's not forever. And you can, like we've said there, you do need to think about it. But I've kind of, like you said, done it backwards. At that time, I was like, right, okay, I need to get my degrees behind me. So I got scouted by Walsall. I was playing for Heena Town, which is like step 5 or 6 of non-league, just men's football. And I just remember getting a phone call from a bloke saying, I've seen you play, I'm going to put you in touch with Walsall. And I was like, yeah, all right then. Like, at that time, I was doing my A-levels. I'd not given up on football, but just kind of thought, okay, football might not be for me. Like, I've got other avenues I can go down. And then all of a sudden went to Walsall in League One. Just went in the October half term when I was in upper sixth and did well. Like, they wanted to sign me, they wanted me there, but I said, look, I'm not prepared to throw away my A-levels, so I can't be there full time, so I'm still going to do my A-levels. And they were like, yeah, that's fine, just play for the youth team on a Saturday. So I went for like 2 months of not training. I would train in like school holidays, but I'd just play for the youth, just turn up on a Saturday and play for the youth team and be at school all week. So it was, again, a different sort of way of doing it. Then I started to get involved with the first team. We had a really good FA Youth Cup run, and sort of drawn attention from the first team manager there at the time, Jimmy Mullen, and he got sacked and Chris Hutchings came in and everything was like dead positive. They wanted me around, but I was like, look, I can't, like, I'm at sixth form. So I spoke to my teachers at sixth form and they were like, look, we're happy for you to kind of be there as long as you keep your grades up, as long as you do the work. So I worked like remotely. So I was in Diggs just doing like my sixth form work. I did maths, biology, French and German A-levels. So I'm doing the work in Diggs and training every day and sort of managing that. And then got to the end of the season and I had this opportunity in the background to go to America. I've not really looked much into the American like collegiate system or university system, but when you start to look into it and it's like, okay, well, I can go somewhere where I can play at an unbelievably high standard, I can get a degree, like, what? There's no real like downside to it. So at the end of that season at Walsall, I was sat down with the manager and just said, look, we'll keep you on for another year as third choice, but you're not going to be in match day squads. They had Clayton Ince and Rene at the time. So it was like, are you really offering it me? Like, it's just, is it like a token kind of thing? And then once you'd sign that pro, America then shuts for you the opportunity, because the collegiate system in America with basketball, American football, with soccer, it's all about amateur. Like, you can't have signed pro and then go to university out there. So I was like, you know what, like, I'm just going to go to America. And I'd never been to the States before. I just thought, right, okay, let's go and do it. So I'd spoken to Duke University in North Carolina, which is one of the top sort of academic and athletic programs in the country. So I went out there, and even that, like, to go to uni out there, I just got a, saw it on Twitter the other day. When I went, it was $75,000 a year to go there. So you're looking at $250,000 for 4 years. I think now it's up to like nearly $90,000 a year. So I got offered a scholarship to go out there because, to be honest, not many people can afford $75,000 a year for the son or daughter to go to university. So I was offered a scholarship, but it was only a one-year scholarship. It was like, right, okay, you can come in. We'll give you a full scholarship to play for the team. Because as a team, they only get 10 full scholarships to give out. So they can give out like 50% to one player, 25% to one. But said, look, we'll give you a full scholarship for the first year. But if you don't come in and play, we're not going to give you the next year. So it's like, well, my education then relies on me performing. So it's another kind of risk where you go, okay, like, it's not really what I wanted, like a full 4 year kind of scholarship to be able to go. And because first years don't usually play out there, you kind of go, you get a feel for it. So I was like, look, am I going to get a chance? And they said, yeah, you get a chance. And I went out and ended up playing every game, stayed there for 4 years and doing really well. But that was kind of a mix of playing full-time football, training every day. And then you'd train every morning. We'd be out there sort of 8:30 till about 11. And you'd start lectures at like 11:45. So you're running off, getting a shower, running to your lectures. But then the demands on a student at a place like Duke University, so it's similar to like you kind of Harvard, that kind of sort of level. And so the demands on a student are so like intense. But then you've got to balance that with playing full-time football. So trying to do that for 4 years to play full-time football and to do a degree and to get all the work done was, again, it was a lot. But as an experience, it was incredible. And looking back on it, like, I wouldn't change it.
I'm fascinated. One, in terms of the ability for you to be able to do that, how did it actually come about?
So when I played for Heena Town, the manager there, he had a company that sent kids to America. So he had one of these companies where kids would go, they'd pay him like a referral fee and he'd find a place for you in America. But with all due respect, a lot of the places the kids go to, it was kind of like a lot of really like lower level non-league lads go into like lower schools out there. So there's not many people that go to like a Division One program. And I remember telling him, so I was doing my GCSEs when I was playing for Heena Town and sort of told him what grades I got. And he was like, wow, like we could, if you thought about America. So then he just rang Duke University and we're like, spoke to the coaches there and we're like, look, I've got this lad, like he's a decent keeper and he's quite bright. Do you want to have a look at him? So they sent over like clips of me playing and then I got a phone call from them and spoke to them and then went through it and did it myself and yeah, ended up going out there. But it was incredible. I met friends for life out there. I had for 3.5-4 years I had some unbelievable experiences. Now that's the kind of path I chose. Had I stayed and signed at Walsall, would my career have been different? I don't know. But at that time, I've always think looking back on your career, at the time is that the right decision for you? And at the time, that was the right decision. So there's no regrets. I don't look back and go, oh, I could have played in the Football League a lot earlier. But yeah, that's how it came about. And it was, yeah, an unbelievable experience.
I think it's a great story. I mean, I'm actually quite jealous, to be honest with you, because you can't have regrets in life, of course. But if there's one thing maybe that I wish I'd done, wasn't bright enough as you, certainly. But I would have loved to have gone to the US to study, just to experience that side of life out there, just because the infrastructure is so different and the attention they pay, especially to the sports side of it. And I know that's not what university is all about, but when I was at uni, for example, we played at Dog Poo Park every Wednesday and there weren't thousands of fans coming to watch us, and we weren't playing in huge stadiums. And even if you did get to the good game at the end of the season, getting people to actually pay £5 to go and watch you play was actually quite difficult. Whereas you guys would have people chomping at the bit to watch you play. You guys are lauded. So I think that side of it is so interesting to get into. And I'm actually quite envious of that. And I think it's definitely, if a goalkeeper is considering taking that route, it's well worth doing. But you mentioned there the juggling. So you were juggling playing football. You were juggling the demands of the academia. There's also the social side to being at university as well, especially as a young English lad in the US. That must have been so difficult to handle too.
Yeah, I think part of your university is your social life. It's growing up, it's finding yourself, it's learning kind of about the world, I guess, making mistakes. I think that we had that element of discipline with us because we were student athletes. We had obviously a training program, we had a vigorous like games program. So there's not a lot of time where you can go out and get steaming. We partied at weekends and like after games and stuff. But yeah, the university lifestyle is similar to what you'd be here. You'd have people going out most nights of the week. It's important to kind of have that. And like I said, it allowed me to sort of make loads of friends. But it was challenging. And especially being away from home, like being away from your family, sort of being out there for sort of 3-4 months at a time. But no, it was, yeah, fantastic.
Friends from the NBA as well, I believe.
Yeah, so this got onto like my Wikipedia thing.
That is where I saw
people
it.
People keep messaging me about that. So yeah, the university I went to, so Duke basketball are like one of the best programs in the country. So one of the most like successful basketball programs. So when, like you alluded to a couple of minutes ago, here you turn on Sky Sports News or any other news channel and you see like the Prem lads, whereas out there you put on ESPN and there's like college basketball, they're almost like celebrities. And there's a couple of lads that were sort of in my year, so Mason Plumlee was one of them, who's still playing in the NBA. I think he's at the Clippers now. But then like Kyrie Irving, who's was at the Brooklyn Nets, he's had a good NBA career, and that was sort of my age. So yeah, you're rubbing shoulders with sort of elite athletes. And yeah, soccer wasn't, I have to call it soccer because that's what it was out there, but that there wasn't like the big kind of pool that there was for sort of basketball, American football. Like some American football college games, you're getting 100,000 people watching. It's insane. Like here, you support like your favourite team, your favourite Prem team, whereas there you'd have your favourite NBA, NFL team, but then you'd have your favourite university team that you'd support and you'd follow, and they'd get all the attention. And it is absolutely crazy. I think the way the American system works with the sports is you have to go to university for a certain amount of time. So you can't go straight into the NBA. You have to do a year of university before you go to the NBA. I think with the NFL, it's 3 years. I'm not too sure about that, but I think it is 3 years. So they've got that system right where they promote education. They want people to continue their education, but give them the platform to play elite level sport, which is something here that we don't have. And I don't think we ever will, because of the money involved in the way the system's set up at the minute. Like lads at 16, 17, 18, or even younger than that are taken out at the big clubs and put into, like, they're schooled by the team, their education kind of takes a back seat. And there's one thing in my career that I have kind of put education first at times, and I think if there's one sort of lesson that people can take from it, it's that you can pursue your education, you can do other things to football than football at certain points of your life, and you can still be successful. We said it earlier, there's no blueprint, there's no like right way of doing things. So I guess with me, it goes to show that, yeah, you can get your education and still end up being a professional footballer.
You've lived the best of both worlds. That's basically what you've done.
Yeah, I like to think so, yeah.
And the subjects, just to finish on your time in the US. So you mentioned your 10 A stars, by the way, which is just bonkers at GCSE in 2 A's. You majored at Duke in history, focusing on Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, and you also left with a business, marketing and management degree. You have to be the smartest goalkeeper you've had on the podcast.
Oh, I don't know about that. But yeah, I did 2 degrees while I was out there. Yeah, I wrote my thesis on Nazi Germany and the occupation of Nazi Germany. And that was just a period of history that kind of fascinated me. And again, found something that I guess I enjoyed, even how kind of somber kind of the topic is. And then, yeah, I managed to pick up a business degree as well, because I thought, well, history degree might not set you up for a few things, whereas a business degree, kind of learning skills that are transferable to, I guess, to football, I guess to any kind of walk of life, you can apply those skills that you learn through any sort of degree, the sort of discipline and the learning that it takes to do that. So yeah, I've got a couple of those degrees behind me. I haven't had to use them yet, so there might be a day when I try and cash in on them if I'm looking for jobs. But that goes back to like with football, like I think I would want to stay on the grass, particularly with the goalkeepers, but then it's like, well, would I want to go upstairs into the business world of football? And kind of, 'cause I think there's a lot that's wrong with that, and that's probably for another podcast, to be honest. But do I want to go in and try and make a difference there? Do I want to work with younger lads and help them and provide sort of support for younger lads? I don't know, but there might be a time when those degrees come in handy. So yeah, I'll keep them in the bank for a bit.
We certainly see them now, the likes of Petr Cech, who go into a more established senior role. So it's definitely open.
Yeah, I think there's the stereotypical goalkeepers are mad, goalkeepers are crazy and stuff. But I think there's a few of us that have got our heads sort of screwed on. So yeah, hopefully it can make a difference in some way.
Stats, by the way, you broke a long-standing record, or at least equaled a record that had stood for a while you were at Duke. You aware of that one?
No, did I?
The goals against average.
Oh, did I?
Yeah, so 2012.
Okay.
You finished the year with 0.70 goals against as an average. That was the best since 1987.
Oh, nice. I take that. Yeah, that was kind of, I mean, now football's very sort of stats-based, and I think with stats can be manipulated to sort of suit any kind of narrative. So in terms of, like, I don't place too much focus on stats, particularly now, but when I was in America, that was very much like how everything was garnered. Like, I remember going on websites and you'd see, like, goals against average, save percentage, well, they called them shutouts, but clean sheets, and you look at stuff like that. And then when it came to, like, the national awards, like, they just were solely like, right, look at the stats, who's letting the least goals, that must be the best goalkeeper. Whereas you and I know that you can look at someone's stats and go, okay, well, he's got great stats, but let's go and watch him, let's see what he's like, let's see how he affects the game. Because how can you quantify, I don't know, defending the space behind, or how can you quantify certain aspects of goalkeeping that you look and go, like, leadership, like, organisation, you can't really quantify it. So I always think, like, stats, it gives people a base, but I know there's a lot of, like, the money ball kind of recruitment side of things in football, but I always think if you're recruiting someone, or you're looking for particularly a goalkeeper, then you have to go and watch them, because you have to get a feel for the personality, because the goalkeeper's going to lead your team, they're going to lead the back four, they're going to organise the back four or back three, whatever you want to play. So I think, yeah, didn't know about those stats, but yeah, I think, like I said, stats can be kind of sort of adjusted to fit the narrative, I guess.
Certainly with goalkeepers well, I think. And I completely agree with you as well on that money ball technique. And of course, there are examples where it's worked very efficiently, Brentford being one, of course, in the Premier League now. But especially with goalkeeping as well, it's about an environment, right? And it's about, and actually outfielders too, it's about that player, that goalkeeper, fitting the right environment for that club, being able to work with a manager, being able to work with a goalkeeper coach, having, like you say, the right personality to fit that club, not just statistically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and that's what, I've worked with some great goalkeeper coaches over the years, and we sort of touched on it before we came on air about the importance of a goalkeeper coach and feeling sort of at home in the environment. And I worked with my goalkeeper coach at Harrogate for 4 years, and we had a great relationship. He could tell when I was what I needed when I needed it. And then again with the coaches I worked with at Bristol Rovers and Tony Warner last year, I had a fantastic relationship with him. I think in terms of influence on my career, he's probably had one of the biggest influences on my career. I think without him, I don't think the move to Bristol Rovers comes about. I think he was really sort of championing that move for me at the time when I left Harrogate, I didn't really have anything. I guess at that time, the summer of 2021, so I just finished the season in League Two, Harrogate had told me that they wanted to sign a keeper with more Football League experience. So they wanted to go down that route, and I had 2 years left on my contract, and I was kind of free to pursue other opportunities. So,
did that surprise you at the time?
Yeah, and it hurt me because I played 180 odd games for the club, been number one for 4 years, got 2 promotions in 3 years, kept them up in the Football League, played pretty much every game. Yeah, it did. It felt a bit like, I felt a bit let down because I had like a good relationship with the staff there, and like I said, there were a lot of my best mates were there. And but I remember at the time, so I'd never worked with an agent before, never had an agent. And then when this was kind of happening, one of my good mates, Aaron Davis, who's now my agent, I just rang him and said, look, can I have a bit of advice? So I remember sitting down for a coffee with him. He lives near me and we're good mates. And he was like, look, like, do you want to come on board with us? And I said, oh, Matt Murray, like, we'll look after you and stuff. So he set up a Zoom, like, a conference call with Matt and Davo, and then we went and had a coffee and stuff, and it was like, okay, like, I've got someone in my corner now. I felt like Matt and Davo have been unbelievable with me, like the support and the help that they've given me, my career, like, it's been incredible, even in such a short space of time. But I was like, right, okay, I've got an agent working for me now, like, one of them, I'll have something. Like, I've got promoted out of the National League, was goalkeeper of the year in the National League the year we got promoted. Like, okay, I'm gonna have, I thought, if I have to drop down, whether it was an arrogance thing or what, I don't know. I just thought, I'm going to get offers in there. But then sort of time ticked along. I spoke to a couple of clubs. Nothing really materialised. And then ended up going back for pre-season with Harrogate. And just nothing came up over the summer. And I guess that, going back to your question, we said, were you, like, how'd you feel? Like, yeah, I was hurt, but I thought something good's going to come up. But it just never did. And then went back for pre-season with Harrogate, turned up and was given squad number 21, like, shirt taken off me and all of this, and was like, right, okay, it's obviously clear that I'm still kind of not wanted. They signed a new keeper, and to be fair, like, I had chats with them and just said, look, like, basically they didn't want me there, I didn't want to be there. It was kind of, okay, something's going to come up. And we went away for a camp with Harrogate. I'd been there 3 or 4 days, but in those 2 days, like, I'd spoke to my missus and was just like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm at a club where I've been number one, I'm now basically not wanted. It was hard, like, seeing all my best mates, like, preparing for a new season. And then Matt rang me and was like, look, Bristol Rovers want to have a look at you. And with the when I left Harrogate in that summer, I thought, said to my missus, she was like, right, okay, well, you can get closer to home, like, you can find somewhere closer to Nottingham. But then I think she saw kind of what I was doing, and then first thing she said was, how far's Bristol? I was like, yeah, it's a long way away. But she'd seen what I was like. She was like, she's always been so supportive. She was like, look, go and do it, go and smash it. So I went on a trial to Bristol Rovers and was there for 2 weeks.
So, going in on a trial.
At 30 years old.
Yeah.
I was nearly 31. So 30 years old, just played a season in the Football League. Had a 2-year deal at Harrogate that I was fortunately was still getting paid. I had to go and earn a contract and was there for a week working with Tony Warner. And obviously the gaffer was there and played a game on the Saturday against Barnet. And was sort of, right, okay, am I going to find out? And they were like, I remember speaking to Tony, and Tony was like, no, Gaffer wants to have another look at you next week. So I was like, okay, like, the pre-season sort of ticking along. And as a goalkeeper, like, I mean, you'll know from your work with goalkeepers, like, once a slot's filled, there's no chance of getting anyone in. Mm. So once you have to wait for that goalkeeper merry-go-round, once that happens, you need to get in quick, otherwise slots become filled and it becomes harder to get in. So I'm thinking, well, I've got another week here, like, could I be going somewhere else? Like, but I remember the goalkeeper coach being like, look, stick it out. You're in the building. Like, you've already got an advantage over anyone else that we'd be looking at. So I had another week and then played against Plymouth in a friendly on the Saturday. And I think that was kind of D-Day for me. And I think there was, people were unsure whether they were going to sign me or what. And then at the end of the game, I remember getting a call from Tony saying, look, the gaffer wants to do it. Let's get it done. And that was just relief because I'd gone through a tough summer, very sort of, because again, it's easy to kind of doubt yourself. It's easy, like, have I made the right decision? Like, what am I going to do? Luckily, I still had 2 years left on my deal. So for lads who are out of contract, it can be quite a daunting time. And yeah, I just felt relief and was like, yeah, I've, again, gone there, backed myself, taken a chance, like, worked hard. But the remit was, right, you're coming in as a number two. And I fully, like, bought into the club. Like, I was like, right, okay, I've been a number one my whole career, yeah, albeit at non-league level, but it's like, right, okay, I'm going as a number two, big club, like, And I just fully bought into it, just fully bought into the like the club, like being at like the training facilities were unbelievable, like stuff I'd not experienced before. And just thought, right, okay, I'll get a chance. And I remember looking and like, right, okay, I might play this game, might play that game, the cup games and stuff. And so I was on the bench for the first couple of games, and then the keeper got injured and it was like, right, here's a chance. And I played pretty much every game after that. And so, yeah, it was a very sort of tough summer because, like you say, you start questioning yourself, you start doubting your ability. And then, yeah, the opportunity came along and then that season's history.
That merry-go-round that you mentioned there is, it's just so influential in goalkeeping, isn't it? And it's something that so many people from outside of the game, I guess, and casual onlookers don't really recognise, especially with goalkeeping more so than outfield players. Because like you say, it's almost like being at the circus and someone pressing the button and the horse is just starting to move round. Slowly but surely, they start to get filled one by one. And like you say, when that spot's gone, it's gone. At the beginning, it's quite exciting because you have this pool of goalkeepers and all these vacancies and you think, right, he can go there, he'll fit there, that guy will go there and he'll slot into his spot. But like you say, once the spot's gone, that's it. So for you, having to make that decision, which I guess is, you know, representative of your career as a whole, you're having to make these massive decisions at these crucial moments. You're making the decision not to sign for Walsall. You're making the decision to go to the US. You're then making the decision when you were drafted by Chicago Fire to actually say, no, I'm going to come back here. And having a 2-year contract there at Harrogate, which you could quite easily just put your feet up and gone, I'm going to stay here. And the whole situation could have got quite nasty. You said, no, I'm going to go on trial to Bristol Rovers. And it's worked out for you, but having to make those crucial decisions at those moments in time were quite key.
Yeah, like you alluded to with the merry-go-round, like if you're a club and you've got three strikers and another one comes in, it's like, oh, okay, we can maybe take another striker. But yeah, slots start to get filled, and if you're not on that seat when everything stops, then it can be a test in time. But yeah, I think with anyone's career, like everyone's got stuff that goes on behind closed doors at clubs that people don't see, that people don't hear about. Football can be a very tough industry. It's one of the hardest industries to work in. Granted, it's the best job in the world, and anyone who plays professional football will tell you that. It comes with a lot of hard work and sacrifice, and like you've said, they're ultimately key decisions at the right time. That I think with those decisions, I was always in control of them, and I do quite well sort of mentally when I'm in control of stuff. I think it's when stuff happens it's out of your control that you then try and like get after or try and change, that's when it becomes a problem. So I think at those times each decision was a tough decision, but at that moment in time, if I kind of transport myself back into my headspace at the time and how I was feeling and what was going on in my life, I think they were all the right decisions. It was just then me having to back myself and go and earn whatever I could off it, go and earn a contract, go and get a number one spot, go and earn another promotion. Like it gave those big decisions have given me the springboard and the platform for the career that I've had. And without them, would I have been there? Who knows? But again, we can always look back in hindsight and question everything. But I think everything I've done, the big decisions have been right for me at that time.
Okay, well, we'll finish on your time as things stand at Bristol Rovers. I guess it's been quite a roller coaster just in the time you've been at the club. So last season, the club were around 16th come the end of the calendar year. You then went on the incredible run that you mentioned earlier. You won 15, lost just 3 of the last 24 matches. You kept 12 clean sheets in that time, the last of which was the incredible 7-0 win against Scunthorpe on the final day. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah, that was something that I don't think will ever be done again. That we were 16th, we were on a bad sort of run, but I think with Rovers, yes, we had one of the bigger budgets in the league and we had some very good players. It just wasn't clicking for some reason. It just wasn't quite clicking for some reason. But no one could really put the finger on it. And then all of a sudden in January, we got some momentum. We picked up some big results. And then, I mean, it helps we signed Elliot Anderson, who was one hell of a player on loan from Newcastle. But then leading up to that, I mean, what people forget is going into the last 2 games of the season, I think we were just outside the playoffs. We were never in the top 3 until the last 5 minutes of the season. We spent more time in the bottom 2 than we did in the top 3 in the season. But the second to last game of the season, we were 3-1 down away at Rochdale with 5 minutes left Well, yeah, but yeah, we scored like 80-something. And then 3-2 down in the 90th minute, and we scored 2 and 1-4-3. And then that took us behind Northampton. So that gave us the platform in the last game to obviously have it be in with a shout of automatic. And I remember playing that game, and first off, like, you could hear, like, the atmosphere was just electric, and then it just died after, like, 5 minutes. So I'm sort of looking around going, have Northampton scored? Like, cause obviously they're playing simultaneously. And I looked to the bench and sort of signalled, like, is it 1-0? And I remember Ansi was just being like, no, it's 2-0. And at that point, I was just like, okay, like, that's kind of going to be it. And it ended up, they were 3-1 up at half-time. We were 2-0 up. So we needed 5 goals. So the gaffer at half-time just said, look, go and take it out of the hands. Just go and give this everything. And that second half was, I don't think I touched the ball. I was just stood there in disbelief as much as anyone was in the stadium. And the fifth, the sixth goes in, the seventh goes in, 84th minute, and everyone's just on the pitch. Fans are going mad. Like, the ref takes us off. So then we have to go off the pitch because obviously all the fans are on the pitch. So we're in the changing rooms, and we've all just had like this adrenaline shot. So everyone's like buzzing, like, oh my God, like, we've got the seventh. And that allowed us, we were watching on a phone, everyone's watching on the phones, like, the Northampton score come in. So that finished 3-1 while we were in the changing rooms. So it's like, right, okay, as it stands, we're up. So I remember Tony Warner, goalkeeper coach, coming up to him, was like, right, Belly, like, they might take a pot shot, they might do this. I'm like, Tone, just relax, just let me just go and play. Like, I've done this all season, just let me go. And I think they had one cross that they put in that I had to come and take in that. We went back out to play. I think the ref said he was going to play 8 minutes. I think he probably played about 6 because we just kept the ball. They had one deep cross that I've come and taken. But I think after that, I just watched and we just kept the ball. And then that's that feeling, that 7-0, like, fans have come on the pitch, you're on everyone's shoulders. And then next thing I know, I look down, I see my old man and my brother. They've fought through the crowd to get to me. My mum was there, and it was just, my missus was actually, she was on a hen do in Marbella, so she's following it in Marbella. Like, it was just insane. And then, yeah, to obviously get to League One in that manner was something that I don't think will ever be done again. And in my career, I think that's probably one of the best teams in Bristol Rovers history, one of the greatest moments, and I've been a part of that. And to be voted Player of the Year and to go up was incredible. I got married that summer as well, so it was quite a summer for me. And then this year, to obviously have a chance to play in League One, first year in League One, I think we've had a steady season. It's been quite up and down. We had started slowly, had a good run, sort of October, November time, dipped a bit around Christmas, and then we've picked up a few results recently that have pretty much stabilised us in that kind of lower mid-table. Still not mathematically safe, so there's still a lot of work to do between now and the end of the season. But I think if you'd have asked any Rovers fans, after going down and then coming back up, I think they'd take a stable sort of League One finish this season.
And this season going well, again, as things stand, very much the number one. But there was a brief period, earlier on in the season. Now, I remember this happening at the time. We spoke about it on our Between the Sticks podcast at length, really, because I couldn't understand why you came out of the side. I was quite confused as to why you came out of the side. You're out of the side for about 4 or 5 games and then returned to the side, now very much the number one, as I said. But just run us through what happened there.
Yeah, so obviously I've been number one all season, and then get Ellery Balcombe in on loan, who's a fantastic goalkeeper from Brentford. I think he was playing at Crawley. Came in, and then he got his chance and was told that Ellery's going to be playing. And as a goalkeeper, it's hard. As any player, like, when you're told you're going to be out the side, it's hard to kind of deal with. You get a lot of emotions going through. And I think particularly when you're a goalkeeper, because there's that kind of emphasis on being the number one, and that kind of, when you're taken out the side, it becomes like a big thing. And it became like almost like a narrative in the press, which I don't think really helped anyone. I think it was just kind of a difficult time for kind of everyone involved. And Ellery came in and did well, showed what he's capable of, and played 5 games, and then the gaffer decided to put me back in. And since then, I've played the last sort of 4 or 5 games, and yeah, hopefully can kind of keep the shirt to the end of the season. But look, the gaffer wanted to stimulate competition in the goalkeeping department, and that's what he's done. Like, Ellery's a fantastic goalkeeper. He's a young lad, he'll have a great career, whether that's at Bristol Rovers, whether that's at Brentford or wherever. But that's the side that, like, the human side of things that people don't really see with footballers. Like, I think people expect footballers to be like robots and just kind of deal with things in a professional manner. I think people deal with things in different ways because people are human beings. Like, you've got emotions, and yeah, it was tough, obviously, being at the side, but gives you chance to reflect and improve on things. And Gaffer told me stuff that he wants me to do differently and what he wants me to work on. And yeah, I like to think that I've gone back in and done well. So I can hopefully sort of play as many games as I can between now and the end of the season. And ultimately, as long as the team stays in the league and we achieve our goals as a team, then that's all that matters.
The reason he gave in that he needed someone, or he felt like he wanted someone to push you, do you feel like you need that when you are a number one? Do you need a number two there that's going to push you?
I think for me, and when I've been in sort of the lower leagues, you can't really afford, the clubs don't have the budget to have two goalkeepers. You have one goalkeeper, then you have someone who, a local lad who will just come in and kind of, that's the role. And I think throughout my career, I've worked well when I've been pushed. I've worked well when I've almost, again, I don't want to come across the wrong way, but when you almost know that you're going to be the number one. And I'm a very, like I said, you can see from my career that I've had to graft and I've had to work hard. So I don't take anything for granted, like where I am. Like, you're in League One, like there's hundreds of thousands of young goalkeepers that would want to be playing in League One. And there's, yeah, when someone comes in, it drives standards. It just kind of, I guess it shakes the apple cart a bit. So you see how people respond. But I like to think that my standards and my levels of training and my levels of performances in games are sort of consistent, whether I'm being pushed, whether I am the number one. But even before Ellery came in, like, Ansi's an international goalkeeper. He's played for Finland before. He's a very, very capable goalkeeper who was pushing me last season and pushing me this season. So yeah, there's always people that want to take your shirt. But yeah, I like to think that my level of performance kind of stays the same, whether you've got someone breathing down your neck or whether you're an established number one or whatever.
And before we get to the final question that will still be asked by Richard Lee, you've kindly donated your fee for this particular podcast to a chosen charity. Just want to just tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so one of our teammates, Nick Anderton, was diagnosed with a rare form of osteosarcoma. Nick was a big part of the promotion winning side last year, and then we came back for pre-season this year and he had a pain in his leg that he was trying to foam roll. Just thought it was a tight quad, and I went for a scan on it and turns out he's got a tumour the size of a meatball in his femur, which was awful. And then for him, all of a sudden, it puts everything into perspective. Football becomes irrelevant when you... His missus, he's got a young daughter, his missus was pregnant at the time, and just going through all of that. And yeah, so we, as a team, we've done a lot of fundraising stuff. We all shaved our heads in January for Nick, because when they operated and took the tumour out, they did a biopsy on it and it was an aggressive form of cancer. All the scans he's had, as far as I'm aware, there's no sign of it spreading in his body, but because of the biopsy that was taken, they wanted to sort of flush his body just with chemotherapy. So it's going through sort of like 9-10 months of intense chemotherapy. And we all shaved our heads in January. We've done some fundraising thing. I think the fundraising page is at about 45, nearly 50,000. So yeah, what I'm going to do with this is put it towards Nick's GoFundMe page. If anyone's looking for that, they'll be able to find it through Bristol Rovers Twitter or my Twitter. I'll put a link up. And yeah, so if people want to donate, for obviously it's a very good cause. So yeah, donate to Nick.
Absolutely. Okay. So the final question, Rich isn't here, of course, but in true Richard Lee fashion, we'll get him to ask the question. So Rich, over to you.
Over to me indeed. Yeah, I like to just chip in at the end of the show to ask the big question, the only question that really matters, and that is, Mr. James Belshaw, what has goalkeeping given you?
So goalkeeping, it's given me a career. It's given me a passion, a focus, and a drive in life. It's given me like my family. I've met friends, wife, everything through football. Everything's been a big part of my life, and goalkeeping it's taught me a lot of lessons. A lot of life lessons. It's put me in positions where, like we've alluded to on the podcast, where I've had to make big sacrifices, big decisions at big times. It's allowed me to learn things about myself, and a lot of ups and a lot of downs in my life have been because of goalkeeping. And yeah, I'm not a master of it. I don't think anyone ever becomes a master of it as much as like Rich or someone might try and say that they are. But yeah, goalkeeping's been a huge part of my life, and yeah, hopefully for many more years to come.
James Belshaw, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem, you're welcome. Thanks for your time.
Well, that's another fantastic save from Belshaw.